I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Paul Ludwig, tenured tutor at St. John's College, Annapolis, about his 2020 book, Rediscovering Political Friendship, Aristotle's Theory and Modern Identity, Community, and Equality from Cambridge University Press. Ludwig works on ancient political theory, especially Plato, Aristotle, and Thucydides. He is the author of many articles, and his last book was entitled Eros and Polis, Desire and Community in Greek Political Theory. So, first of all, Paul Ludwig, let me say welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Paul, I love the book in several different ways. I thought it was an excellent book, a close reading of Aristotle, very illuminating reading of Aristotle, and a very excellent application of his thought to reviving civic friendship today. So an interesting application to contemporary liberalism, contemporary liberal theory, and a really wide-ranging discussion throughout the book across a number of different thinkers. It's not just Aristotle, but Tocqueville, Hegel make appearances. So, and on top of that, public policy, you dip into public policy here and there. So really admirable. Thank you for the book.
Oh, well, it's great to hear praise of it, of course. And I really enjoyed writing it.
Good. Well, why don't you say a little bit about what motivated you to write the book in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess that's kind of funny because this was going to be a quick ripoff of another form of love. You know, I'd written a book on Eros in political theory, Plato, Thucydides, and treating Aristophanes as a kind of theorist. And, you know, I'd learned a lot about philia just by studying Eros in Greek. And I thought I could get another publication out very quickly. This was around 2001, 2002, so 18 years later, the book was out. Of course, all the polarization and stuff that become, in a way, a focus of the book, that those were added later, that just didn't seem to be a problem at the time that I was starting. I think the relevant texts of Aristotle were before me. As I did the dissertation, there's the famous Politics Book 7, a very difficult passage and kind of elliptical that philia comes from the thumos, the spirited or angry part of the soul. And I thought I could just make a lot of hay out of that. And I think my beliefs about friendship and civic friendship have changed many times. I've gone down many really wrong paths and tended to run with one idea to the detriment of others during the ensuing 18 years or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. I mean, the preface begins with just right after the 2016 election. So I want to get there eventually. I mean, to your thoughts about the changing American landscape. I'm glad that you sort of brought that up at the onset. I mean, just to sort of get through, the overall argument here, I wanted to maybe have you spend a little bit of time just saying a little bit about what you take civic friendship to mean and why we need it in a liberal society.
Right. Yeah. So the book, and I guess I still stand behind this, really takes a kind of low view of friendship. This is the last thing I want this to be is pie in the sky. I'm taking in some ways a very modern view. I'm, running with parts of Aristotle and maybe leaving virtue somewhat to one side because I just don't think it applies to us, at least not directly, if it applied to his society or not. I think civic friendship is a feeling that citizens feel for other citizens. I don't think it's really a choice. I think most people have it. It's not really all that mysterious. It's like the same kind of feelings of of kind of ownership and rivalry that you would have if you're on a team with somebody else. So it's really very analogous, and this is Aristotle too now, to family love. You know, you're in a family together. Brothers often hate each other, but they hate each other in a specific way, right? That is reserved for brothers. So I think that's, in a way, what civic friendship is. So it, in some sense, it's this book is a kind of plea to empirical social scientists to study these passions. I think that's really the only way to get them taken seriously. I think if I present this as something we need, you know, here's the panacea for our polarization, right? I think it's just going to be, you know, a few people will say, yeah, if only people would do what Ludwig said, and then it'll all die down in another, you know, after 15 minutes of fame, and that'll that'll be it. So I mean, I think this is something real. I think our current polarization is the kind of internecine strife that Aristotle talks about between brothers who love each other or have loved each other very much and have been disappointed with one another, and they hate all the more because of their prior love. Or from a certain perspective, that love and that hate are all one thing. Although that gets us into very deep and tricky metaphysical waters right away. I think we need it. I think it would be good for polarization, but in a sense, we already have it. In some sense, we're suffering from it. So again, if this were, you know, part of a political campaign or slogan, I think that would be probably not good. I would distrust the type of politician who came up and said, yeah, we need more friendship. I mean, I agree with Jefferson on that one. That's probably going to be the wolf in sheep's clothing in liberalism. On the other hand, there's something really empirical about this that I think needs to be taken into account. And once we see a sort of reality of it, then perhaps in a more therapeutic type way, we can kind of understand what's going on in our own hearts as individual citizens, understand why our fellow citizens feel miffed, why they feel dishonored. It's because, you know, for many years, you know, we've valued international markets over our, you know, it's been anybody first, aside from our fellow citizens. So, you know, I think there are a lot of applications to today's politics, but maybe nothing that would be particularly surprising or, you know, nothing we don't already know in a way.
Yeah, good. Just to dwell here for a second, because just to follow up on a few things that you said. On civic friendship as a kind of feeling, how do you distinguish between, say, you know, the as you said, you know, it seems like the polarization in American politics, maybe like, you know, siblings who have, you know, come to dislike one another. How do you distinguish that kind of feeling from, I mean, sometimes it seems like the polarization in American politics looks more like enemies. I ask that in part because I'm wondering about the empirical social science angle, which I found interesting in the book as a sort of suggestion, you know, how to operationalize a concept like friendship, like how, you know, when you look at, when you look empirically, you can't see a feeling, right? But you can presumably sort of discern certain kinds of behaviors. In any case, I don't know if you have any thoughts about those two different sort of questions.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like my thoughts probably won't go very far, that I really need to hand this off to the people who do know about operationalizing concepts like that, and, you know, what's measurable and what's not. I mean, from a certain perspective, I certainly hear what you're saying, that, you know, enemies get angry at each other, friends get angry at each other. You know, the empirical social scientist comes along, anger is anger. All he sees are behaviors that look like anger in both cases. I mean, that certainly seems like a valid criticism and something that would have to be dealt with by anybody who really wanted to, you know, make sure what they were looking at. In the case of brothers, in some ways it's easier. One there's a history, you know, one knows the family where two sisters, you know, just are got at each other's throats at some point. They weren't that way before, you know. Perhaps something analogous to that could be done in the U.S. I mean, we weren't always this polarized. I think there were, you know, broad agreements. And obviously that agreement is a huge part of civic friendship. In a way, it's one of Aristotle's definitions, the various definitions that have to be put together by the reader, because he never deigns to do those. He just calls them all civic friendship in one place or another. So, you know, agreement on the regime, I think, is a big factor that still exists in America underneath our polarization. I think you can see a lot of agreement about the regime. You know, we went through a kind of, well, we're in a silly season now, but we went through a different kind of silly season where progressives, you know, wanted more democracy, right? You know, now I think they start to see with Aristotle that regimes are all connected, and the extreme of democracy is not more democracy, it's tyranny. So populism, right, the people need a focus for to express their will, and that will tends to get focused on one person, and that person, you know, in ancient society, he would first ask for a bodyguard, and then that, you know, that defensive body would become an offensive army. You know, it's a little different now, but I think progressives at least can see that you know, whatever their people can reasonably differ about the Electoral College, but I think everyone in a sense can see that too much, you know, direct style voting does not always lead you to the best leader, right? It's some kinds of forms through which the people's will is expressed are needed. And in some ways, it's, you know, it's sad, but to a kind of, I guess you'd say, social conservative like myself, it's heartening to see progressives defend the Constitution against the Trump administration's various outrages. So, you know, I guess I'm cautiously optimistic that sort of American agreement, or, you know, what Aristotle calls homonoia, like-mindedness, about matters of importance, like the regime, I think that's still intact. And in some ways, I feel like our polarization hides from us just how broad a ground of common agreement there are, even on policy issues. It's remarkable, you know, political scientists see it, just how many things Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump agree on, but they can't say they agree on it because they're on different sides, right? So you have to find some little thing to show that you're actually different from the other side, because we can't agree with what he thinks. So, you know, I my hope is that this too will pass, and I'm not sure that, you know, my book is going to have a whole lot to do with it. With it.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I agree with, I think, almost all of that. I mean, one thing I'm tempted to ask you about, although maybe I'll hold off and maybe we can just get into your book. But I mean, you discussed before the ways in which friendship is emotional or affective. And one of the things I'm wondering is how it matches up with what you were just saying about the, I don't know, call it the principle, you know, a friendship built on principle, right? I mean, you also talk about utility in the book, which is another kind of plank of friendship, or psychological plank, I guess you could say. There's a sort of emotional or passionate, thumotic element to friendship. There's a utilitarian element to friendship. But this other element, this sort of principled element, you know, I'm wondering what happens to that element. I don't know. I mean, welcome to say a little bit about that now, or if you want to, we sort of have it unfold in the discussion. It's up to you.
Yeah, I mean, we can revisit it, but I mean, I guess I would say that, I don't want to draw too heart aligned between the heart and the head. I think that might be maybe a little more modern than, and I'm a little more ancient, you know, with Aristotle. Yeah, sure. So the theoretical life, if any of us could actually lead that life, yeah, maybe it's all rational and not a matter of the heart. But, you know, I would think that, you know, Aristotle's rhetoric as a kind of, you know, not a handbook for manipulation, but a theory of civic discourse is really the right way to think about political principles, right? These are not just habits of the heart. They have rational content, but that content, you know, you hear the word spoken and they touch the heartstring. It's not algebra, right? When you you have a kind of principle, the you know, liberty and equality are principles, but they are very affective. You know, there's a cathexis of our passions that resides on those two words, and I think, you know, you have to sort of keep those things together in your mind when you're thinking about politics, and to kind of don't run with it. It's too easy to categorize one. Okay, that's the rational side, and now we'll talk about the emotional side, you know, later. I think that cuts the animal in half and kind of kills it before you get to see how it moves. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good. So let's get into the book. It's roughly divided into three parts, as far as I understood it. That you start with a discussion of friendship as such in the ancient world and applying it to the modern world or contemporary world and the psychological foundations for friendship. The second part is about friendship in associations, associational life. And the final part is on friendship in political society. So I thought we could start with the first part on friendship as such and the sort of psychological underpinnings of it. And I was struck, as you said at the beginning, about the, you described it, I think, as a sort of low view of friendship. You started the first chapter with an account of the thematic basis of friendship, and the second chapter on the utilitarian or utility based aspect of friendship. And maybe we could start with the thumos side of things. So maybe you could lay out how is it that friendship arises from this desire for honor, desire for recognition, the sort of anger that's characteristic of that motion of thumos.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to say it necessarily arises. The coming to be of a friendship strikes me as maybe not thumic or thumoid in the end, but I think the sort of a maintenance of it, getting very modern here, Machiavelli, right? Acquire and maintain. The acquiring of a friend is one thing, but the maintenance of the loved one, I think, I just think there are phenomena that are observable that we kind of all feel this way. A friend becomes a kind of second self. And you know, there's high-minded sort of good and just ways of taking that. And then there's this sort of maybe more common, vulgar or ordinary ways to have, you know, who wouldn't want a second self, right? And I think, you know, maybe the best place I found, at least to illustrate it in the book, was this passage from Tolstoy's War and Peace, where one of the characters, the wife of the character, is feeling neglected and maybe not dishonored exactly, but, you know, worried that he doesn't love her anymore. And there's a certain sense in which he doesn't, right? He's not romancing her anymore. This is not erotic in quite the same way. Perhaps they have sex at night, but we all know that doesn't have to be fully erotic in the sense that it can be. But what he really doesn't want is that relationship to her disturbed. And he's kind of angry and upset at her for disturbing it, right? So, you know, come on, what, you think I don't love you? I don't love my finger, but if somebody tried to cut it off, boy, then I would really, you know, that's the way a lot of us feel about our family members, for sure. I think we feel about our fellow citizens that way too, on a very, you know, much less degree. And even our friends, although what we call friends is, of course, a more narrow concept than, I mean, Aristotle had the concept, but he used this, for that concept, he used the same word as family members, loved ones of all sorts. So there's an ambiguity there, that there's an equivocation in Aristotle that you have to constantly sort out. But, you know, friends in the highest sense, friends that you know, we meet somebody at work or play. And I think even there, there's a great deal of a kind of conservatism in our love for them. We want things to stay the same. You know, we don't want them taken away from us. So that's maybe where we get into the dishonoring and the, you know, if a friend is challenged, if a friend is under attack, or if the friend, you know, attacks us and sort of wants to leave, wants to move out, wants to not be our friend anymore, I think we feel like something's been being taken away from us. So that the flip side of the feeling that we had for them, whatever the good, the warm, the fuzzy feeling was, the flip side of that is the possessive, the angry, the reactive. And that's, I think, maybe Aristotle's biggest passional insight about the passions, that's probably the most interesting. And that's, of course, the Politics 7 passage, which, again, is elliptical and therefore difficult to interpret. But, you know, he jumps to anger to prove it, you know, to prove that philia is thumoid. He immediately starts talking about how it reacts in anger when the friend is threatened or threatens to dishonor us. So I think in the maintaining of the friend, you see a kind of emotion. I don't think that emotion is quite the same as in the acquiring of the friend. But of course, a lot of friends we don't really acquire, right? Our family, loved ones, our civic friends, we're kind of stuck with them. So the whole acquisition phase is not really there, but the maintenance phase covers all.
Yeah, good. I mean, so if I have this right, it's a sort of, you know, a violation to a friend is essentially a violation to ourselves, right? When somebody hurts our friend, we feel it. When somebody insults my friend or something, there's a sort of implicit insult to ourselves. Is that sort of where it's going here? That's absolutely why it activates that anger.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, good. And it's, I mean, what I found one of the helpful things about this chapter is the connection to contemporary identity politics, which also occurred to me in thinking through this issue, because there's a lot of anger in there, right? There's a lot of elements of friendship, of fellow feeling, but there's also a way in which there's a kind of righteous anger that sort of dwells up. Maybe you could talk about that connection.
Yeah. So it's tough. You know, the last thing I want to do with this book is alienate any group. But I guess we've seen enough of identity politics now to know that it exists or can exist on both the left and the right. And, I guess just from on a kind of passional level, that spirit of ours is always looking for something to identify with, or, you know, to, what is my group, right? The question eventually becomes, who am I? It's a way of defining ourselves as well. And I feel like the ancients knew about this. I mean, I think you really need Hegel and some of his modern interpreters to fully understand identity politics, but there's no question but that Plato and Aristotle, in thinking about the tripartite soul, that, you know, the Republic sort of introduces it, and Aristotle kind of sort of accepts it, runs with it, even though it's not really, doesn't really seem to be his psychology. You know, it's in that middle part, the thumos, the reactive, the perhaps honor-loving, or at least honor-preserving part of the soul, that we really want to have an identity at all. Desire doesn't really need an identity. It's perfectly happy just fulfilling itself. The mind, sure, it seems like, you know, you can't really have a desire for an identity without the mind. But there's a certain way in which the mind is the most anonymous thing about us, especially when it's qua mind, when it's acting as mind, right? It's reflective. It's trying to find out what among its perceptions is really true. What, you know, when you and I are both looking at something, it would be odd for me to say, Jeffrey, this is my truth about that thing. No, I'm trying to convince you that what I see as my truth is actually true, and it really has nothing to do with it being Paul's, right? And I think you're doing the same thing. And so there's an odd kind of way in which mind as mind is the same everywhere, and not particularly concerned with identity, or really is sort of anonymous. But it's when this desire to not have anything taken from us, or to maintain our place in the world, that kind of middle, those passions from the middle part of the soul get activated, that I think we start to look at our associations as identities, things that, you know, where I belong, how I fit in, this is me, this is mine, these are my people, right? It seems to me that these ancient theorists, in their very rough and ready psychology, you know, it's a very practical psychology, I don't think it holds up, you know, this as a theoretical psychology, right? There's tons of problems with it, but as a political psychology, I think it really does shed light on, the contemporary search for identity and the desire to make identity, a competitor with interest, right? Politics is not just about interest. It's about identity. It's about who we are, who I am, and me getting my identity served in some way, right? I see other people getting their identities served. I want mine served as well. I just feel like this ancient psychology can kind of help sort that out.
Yeah, one of the questions that I had about the Aristotelian psychology around this is a sort of extended self is how to deal with, well, when thinking about friends, you know, I can see the bite of the explanation that friends are in some sense an extension of ourselves, but in some ways friends are also not like or like us, and that's in some ways what's kind of great about them, you know, that they do things that are unexpected, that they're other. And I wonder about how the Aristotelian explanation deals with the sort of otherness of the friend. I mean, you know, one worry I have with something like a view about friendship as a sort of extension of the self is that wouldn't it follow that if a friend does something that's not like what I expect or not an extension of me, I'd get angry at that, right? Because that's a kind of violation of myself too. So there's a kind of way in which anger might be turned inward into a friendship when friends don't agree. But in some ways, I guess it strikes me that friendship can be enriched by the sort of this sort of deep otherness. I don't know what you think of that.
No, I mean, I totally agree. And I think, this shows in a way my kind of low, narrow, modern focus that, Aristotle would definitely say that the friend helps us get out of ourselves, right? But his highest friendship does not really seem available to most people, you know, it's his elitism, his kind of super aristocracy, right? There's the Greek aristocrats whom he butters up, but then there's the philosophers, which are, I think he definitely thinks are better than the Greek aristocrats. And sure, the passion of friendship extends from self to other, and that makes it always thumoid and always, I think, dangerous. But of course, in a virtue friendship, particular friendship of intellectual virtue for Aristotle, the two friends would be thinking about their friendship all the time and thinking about what was enriching in it and what was not. And, you know, they would, in some real sense, I think, be trying to combat the passions, especially the thumoid passions that could drive them apart. I guess what I don't want to do is change the definition of friendship, at least the passional part, just to make it, you know, just to make friendship, you know, just to make you and I more sanguine about the possibilities for friendship. That seems to be a mistake. But I don't want to foreclose what you said, because I think that the friend as other, as a second self, plays a crucial role in getting us out of our own heads.
I guess what I have in mind is the examples that you bring up in the book about identity politics, which sometimes in some forms can veer into the, you know, just celebration of who I am, my identity, without a sense that, well, a group's identity can be very, very heterogeneous internally, or you can have growth about that identity and so forth. And I guess there's one way in which I think about, you know, is there a way internal to the Aristotelian notion of the psychology of the friendship that allows for that, or that facilitates that growth?
Right. Right. And there, I think I'd have to say no. I don't see that in Aristotle. It does seem to me that the path to growth for Aristotle would be through philosophizing and calming the passions down, rather than finding in the passion itself. You know, he has quite a bit about high-minded friends, friends of moral virtue, and, you know, the way their competitions don't always lead to anger, right? But he certainly leaves the door open for, yeah, they can sometimes get pretty angry at each other. And, of course, in that Politics 7, that's in the Ethics, in the Politics 7 passage, he's explicitly talking about a megalopsychos, a great-souled individual who is getting angry when a bit, someone he's benefited casts the benefit back in his teeth. So that, you know, I don't think Aristotle is sanguine about the passion. That doesn't mean friendship is not, you know, even if any of us were truly philosophic, that we wouldn't be working our way out of the passions, you know, via this passion, which is certainly, you know, both more dangerous and has more potential for good than lower bodily passions, desires.
It strikes me that that's right. Then the early modern, you know, classical liberals were probably right in trying to tamp down on this emotion, this honor seeking emotion, right?
Right. I think we have to take our hats off to them. The justly decried Machiavelli, right? You know, we live in a world where justice is so much better than what the Greeks experience. You know, and you know, for me to come along and say, oh, well, we need to tweak this a little bit more back toward the Aristotelian direction, right? You know, that's talk about being the the dwarf sitting on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah, let's talk about utility, because I found this chapter really it's fascinating too. As utility sits at the basis of friendship for Aristotle. I mean, it sort of, it threw my mind for a loop because, you know, of course, all of us know about Aristotle. There, you know, there's these three different kinds of friends, and Aristotle talks about in the Ethics what friends from utility, friends from pleasure, and friends based around the good. And maybe you could just say a little bit about how utility plays into your account there, and how it sort of informs, or how we can explain that passage from Aristotle based on your account of the sort of utilitarian centric account of friendship.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly want to make sure to preserve utility as a basis of friendship and not be too high-minded and say, well, only pleasure friends and only virtue friends are real. Because if we get rid of utility, then civic friendship becomes a non-starter. Citizens like each other because of each other's utility. I mean, that's explicit in the Eudemian Ethics and certainly implicit in the Nicomachean Ethics. So, you know, you want to preserve this basis. I think utility has much more to do with the acquisition of friends, right? We've talked about the passion that maintains friendship, but, you know, just thinking about drumming up business or creating a grassroots network to promote a political campaign, or utility, what somebody's good for matters in how we make our friends. And often the feelings seem to go beyond that, but the basis can often remain the same, right? Utility friends don't necessarily take pleasure in each other's company. They might, you know, it could grow into that. It could morph into a pleasure friendship too, but there's no reason to, think badly about a lower friendship just because it hasn't become a higher friendship. And I know that in a way begs the question of whether utility friends are friends at all. So I guess I would say that utility is a type of the good. It's not the highest good, perhaps, although even that somewhat a vexed metaphysical issue in Aristotle. One of his formulations for utility is that it's the apparent good, and what's apparently good for me. You know, what's good for one, or apparently good for one, is one word we have for that is utility. So, you know, obviously there's some Kantian sense in which if I'm just a user, right, then I'm not really a friend. I think we can all see that there's some truth to that. But on the other hand, there are, you know, people in our lives, oftentimes it can be very mundane. And I think one great thing about liberal society is it frees us up so amazingly from utility friends, from having to make friends for utility, that we sometimes forget that it's even possible. And, you know, it's very easy to think just pleasure friends and virtue friends are real friends. But, you know, I go to the grocery store, I see the same person every time. Eventually he starts to recognize me too. I like that he's there each time. This is a very trivial example, right? In democratic Athens, you would be finding your utility friends in a much more red-blooded way than this. Yet, I do think, I'm friends with my auto mechanic. I'm friends with my greengrocer. These are not high or noble friendships, but they are friendships. I think they go beyond friendliness. I don't think I'm being friendly just to get something back, although there is that. It would be crazy for me to not be friendly, but I think it goes beyond that. That a feeling takes over, and when my GP is retiring, I'm going to be sorry not to see him twice a year, and maybe correspond one or two other times. I kind of like the guy, but it's clearly a utility friendship and nothing but. or nothing more.
Yeah, I have a guy who cuts my lawn every week. It's much too hot to cut my own lawn in Houston, but and he's been doing it for like 2 years, and he's not particularly good at his job. I always describe it as he's still learning his trade. In any case, but you know, my wife often says, "Why don't you just get somebody better?" And I feel bad about getting out one day and firing the guy. I mean, and I don't, you know, I'm capable of doing it. It's not like I'm capable, but I agree with you. I mean, there is some element of friendship that's there, even if I, you know, I've maybe talked to the guy, you know, for an hour over the past 2 years. So
yeah, you scratched out a little niche in your heart.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, maybe you could sort of connect this up to the, I mean, the title of the chapter is Friendship for Utility is a More Realistic Social Policy, but a More Idealistic Civil Society. So I think maybe you could just sort of lay out those for us. So in what way is this sort of a friendship for utility could lead to a more realistic social policy, but a more idealistic civil society?
Yeah, thanks. There's a lot there. That's hard. I guess I would say that our utility relations cut very close to home, and we often don't realize just how much assumptions of utility govern even some of our more intimate relationships, such as even our family love. So Aristotle goes so far as to actually state, and I think this kind of shows his realism. You know, there's a wonderful idealism about the friendship of virtue, but at the kind of lower level, especially in the Eudemian ethics, he as much as states that humans and other animals both have children for utility purposes. Right, that we if children were totally useless to us, we probably wouldn't have them. And I try to make a case that the larger families of the global South are partly, I think there's a little bit of empirical studies to back this up, data to back this up, are partly due to utility needs of the parents, and that the less than replacement levels of child production in modern Western countries are also, in a real sense, just the flip side of that, that we don't need children anymore for utility purposes. So children become a kind of, more of a pet or a kind of boutique. I want fulfillment through having a kid instead of, fulfillment in a higher sense, pleasure, rather than I need a kid to plow the family farm. So it seemed to me that this was kind of a wonderful example, if you accept the empirical studies, of course, of the way utility is a factor in real social policy issues that are in some ways of dire importance. I mean, I didn't know about Jonathan V. Last's book. I should have. By the time this was out, the book was about 7 years old. But, we really aren't replacing ourselves, and there could be pretty dire consequences for that. So it seemed to me that, if anybody wants to, say, help the family or look at social policy, they really need to do so through, with the blinders off, with the kind of realism of Aristotle. It's wonderful. Aristotle is capable of idealism, but it always grows out of some real soil, right? That you really have to start with the dirt, the kind of ground level. I think utility is kind of shown in this way, or I hope it's shown to be a kind of, really ground level issue that, any kind of family policy that's not taking utility into account is probably being too high-minded or just blinding itself to the inevitable basis that it's going to have to, one way or another, it's going to be forced upon it.
Yeah, and the idealistic civil society side, I mean, I'm assuming this is, part of the, way in which utility has the possibility of growth sort of built within it. I found fascinating the account in your chapter here about how being a benefactor to someone else actually can improve the, the friendship. I don't know if you want to expand on that.
Lead to anger if
right.
Beneficiary betrays you. So there's always that. But yeah, right. I think from a purely feeling, just the passion point of view, doing good to others definitely extends the self in a very pleasurable way, and causes you to love the beneficiary. Whether he loves you back, much more problematic for Aristotle. So utility is a kind of germ or seed of activity for Aristotle. And this, of course, gets into his metaphysics, where some people don't want to go. I tried to, again, take a pretty low view of this. It seemed to me that activity is sort of part ownness and part utility. And you could, you a la the moderns, you could separate those out and treat them individually, but that it was at least worth exploring, what activity is like in its own right. And I do think we see this principle. If you join a political party and you throw heart and soul into it, yes, of course you can be disappointed, and that causes a greater reaction than if you'd never joined. But many people find a lot of fulfillment in this, right? Or if you've got a job that that requires a lot of you, it's amazing how much of self one can invest in things that are not the self, right? The moderns tend to debunk this. They want us to shrink into, each one of us to shrink into the Cartesian ego. Rousseau has this hilarious passage, something, I'm going to butcher it, but if you pinch a businessman in India, he'll scream in London or something like, right? That's one of the way commerce even it partakes of this kind of activity, what Aristotle would call energia, the quality of being at work. And I think other examples might be a civic spectacle. There's a wonderful treatment of the Calgary Stampede along these lines. I think we see it somewhat in not this Memorial Day so much, of course, because nobody could do anything. But there's a, usually with a 4th of July or Memorial Day, there's a kind of a civic ritual that people go through. Maybe it's too often just become a kind of barbecue or a day at the beach. But I think, lots of times people will make an effort. They'll go to a parade. They'll sit through something. They'll hear a speech. And this is a kind of investment of self into something larger than ourselves, which I think Aristotle would call, that activity, which is kind of it's sort of one of the roots of civic friendship, and really of all kinds of friendships on their different levels. But the civic kind would, especially be in civic celebrations, perhaps even in certain forms of commerce, and certainly in absolutely in political participation.
Yeah, it strikes me that That's exactly right. I mean, any time that we invest ourselves in things, we invest, we do that. We invest ourselves. We put ourselves into the thing that we're throwing ourselves into. And so we see ourselves reflected back at us in that activity. And so kind of delight in the, in the, in our existence that we see there. I mean, I will add though, it strikes me that there have to be the right conditions for that to be possible. You know, so if you throw yourself, I think you used the example work before, if you throw yourself, you're expected to throw yourself heart and soul into work, it could be really rewarding, especially if you're writing books like we are, right? And then talking about them on a podcast. But if you're throwing yourself heart and soul into, you know, being a paralegal or something, or being flipping burgers at Burger King, and you don't get, you know, recognition for that activity, is it something important? I mean, maybe this is the sort of thematic element that that maybe comes back in, but it strikes me that that's got to be a part of the account here, that for a benefactor to actually extend themselves, the benefactee has to have some kind of recognition of the benefactor, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I make a case. Well, for Aristotle, it's fairly clear that, you know, there's a kind of, there's a mass and an elite, and the elite, they're getting honor, for their benefactions and their activities. The mass, he wants to say that their civic friendship is, the you know, what they're getting out of it, the honor they're getting is, money. Or it's at least a marker for the civic friendship. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And of course, it doesn't translate easily to modern society. I mean, I think there still probably is a kind of mass and elite. And of course, those are not Aristotle's terms. Those would be modern sociology's terms. So that there'd be a lot of hairs to split there, I think, before we could be sure we're saying something even remotely true. But so yeah, I think that would be a place for policy makers and people who think about policy to never lose sight of the honor quotient, the recognition part of money, that you know, however great money is as utility, it means something. You know, how much people make means something to them as a kind of reward for services rendered, as a way that society honors them for their contribution. I think, you know, we lose sight of that. You know, I'm not against, you know, raising the minimum wage, but there's something about the minimumness of it that has a way of reducing that honor, that the person who's getting it is not getting a raise for a job well done, but just get right. So I think we need to always see in that light as well. Money, you know, it's crucial that the classes in America do not grow too wide apart, so wide that civic friendship is impossible. But, you know, it's very hard to just give people more money, right? They need to think they're earning it. And why not, instead of just, you know, fooling them into thinking that, why not, you know, be straight on both sides that, yeah, they are, in fact, earning it. You know, that's just kind of one place where I think utility and activity, there's a bleed or a blend there. It's much too easy to be reductive about that and see only the utility side and not the heartstrings that are attached to that utility.
Yeah, that's I also found in this regard your discussion of Locke. I think this is in the section we're just going to turn to now about the associations, but in the discussion about the early modern thinkers like Locke were very attentive to this kind of the way in which activity and self-esteem are built into our labor and the way we make a difference in the world, which is often overlooked, right? And in the way that we think about Locke and so forth. I don't know if you want to say anything in general about, I mean, this might be a good chance to say, you know, where you see, because there are a lot of similarities, I think, that you draw between the early moderns and Aristotle. I don't know if you want to say anything about, you know, what you take to be the main differences there or, yeah, I mean, why turn to Aristotle rather than, yeah, the view of friendship that we can get out of Locke or Tocqueville?
Yeah, good. Yeah. Huh. Right. So I guess as I read, right, so I'm an ancient person, so there's an initial, you know, a bias, but yeah, as I read Tocqueville, of course, I find a lot of Aristotelian, a lot of things that remind me of Aristotle. They're a little scattered around. They seem to be more systematic in Aristotle, but he's, you know, because he knows America better than Aristotle did, it's a wonderful application in a way of ideas that could be similar to Aristotle's. Then you see how they're playing out, at least in one kind of America, not too far distant from, well, pretty far distant from the one we have today, but maybe recognizable. Locke, I don't feel I know quite as well. You know, it does seem to me that Aristotle's philosophy was somehow vulnerable to being taken over by the Christian Church. I think I get to say that because I'm a Christian myself, but it, as you can see, I don't think it plays a whole very great role in this book, which, you know, it's kind of based on pagans and mostly philosophers I would consider anti-Christian in one way or another. But it, there was this medieval synthesis that kind of baptized Aristotle, and wonderful as that might have been from a purely philosophical standpoint, I think it stood in the way of certainly of any kind of progress and or most kinds of what we would consider progress, and that, you know, I don't want to say Aristotle deserved what he got, but there was a reaction in which maybe the baby was thrown out with the bathwater. Locke, of course, has it both ways. He's got natural law, but the deeper you read, the more he seems to mean something different by it. My John Locke is, yeah, as you started the question with, you know, a capitalist who understands some of the, I think, psychological underpinnings of capitalism without maybe calling them friendship or, right, he would never say, well, civic friend, you know, there are two types of civic friendship, mass and elite, and the mass one is money and the elite one is, no, we're not talking about friendship at all there, but it's so close in a way, and I did think, you know, for this book, just because, you know, capitalism had gone through this phase where both left and right embraced it. It was very odd. And we thought that global capitalism was the savior kind of all things. And, you know, bad things that happened to our fellow citizens didn't really matter all that much as long as the overall, you know, all boats will float higher as long as the tide keeps rising. It was an odd season that we went through, and as this book neared the press, I just got worried that both sides had gotten disgusted with capitalism in a way that they were about to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. And what we really need is a kind of more humane capitalism along the lines that Paul Collier or scholars like that would try to propose, you know, rather than socialism or you know, the kind of full odd kind of fully protective protectionism. So I suppose there's a certain way in which Locke was a little bit of a late addition to the book. But it seemed like we needed to say something about the origins of the modern regime, just to maybe make plausible how some of what Aristotle says about politics still applies, or we can still, at least theorists can still learn from it today. One thing I really wanted to avoid was this kind of simplistic, why can't we all be friends? And, you know, Aristotle's system just looks so much more attractive than what we've got today. You know, it's so high-minded. I can't stand reading that kind of scholarship myself, and I didn't want to add to it.
Yeah, and it comes forward, I think, well in the second part on the associations, which we've been starting to talk about here. And the Tocqueville connection is helpful, who discusses self-interest, rightly understood, as one of the bases for the development of institutions in American life. And that sounds rather similar to, the account that you're offering about the way in which utility friendship sort of grows into something important. And so at least part of the point about this second part is to, I guess, establish how we have a flourishing form of civic friendship in front of us in the form of the many associations that Americans have, in the way that Tocqueville described. Of course, there's always whenever you talk about Tocqueville, you always got to bring up Robert Putnam and the element of bowling alone and
right.
The sort of decline and of these associations. So is there anything that Aristotle can help us in thinking through the decline or revival of these kinds of associations as a way to sort of revive civic friendship?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, just the fact that Tocqueville is such an aristocrat himself and so worried about equality and its progress toward a kind of emptiness. For somebody like that to base everything on self-interest, rightly understood, kind of low, he's finding low but solid ground on which to. I think he sees that as, he's actually interviewing Americans and he's hearing that from them. You know, why do you help your neighbor? Oh, well, he might help me someday. Instead of, I'm generous or I'm a charitable individual. They're not saying that. They're taking this lower view of themselves. For Tocqueville to do that is in a sense a rebuke, I think, to my project that, it may be that Americans or liberal Democrats more generally around the world, we may never be able to use what for us I think is a high-minded term, friendship, to describe our civic loves and our civic fellowship. It might just be that just seems too high-minded to us, that we're cured of those kinds of, that's the kind of talk that leads to fanaticism. And I think my own reading of Tocqueville on those points is that he thought better of his Americans than his Americans thought of themselves. He says, sometimes I think they're actually showing generosity. They're showing sparks of generosity natural to man. But they want to honor their philosophy, this kind of much more low-minded philosophy. They'd rather do honor to their philosophy than to themselves. And I think he thought on one level that's healthy, and it's something that can last. It's solid. But in another way, it's almost laughable. I mean, if somebody who's not under the spell of the regime sees that and say, these people have swallowed an ideology. What are they talking about? They help their neighbor because they love their neighbor. They want their neighbor to prosper. There's a barn raising or tree falls on the guy's roof, you go help take the tree off his roof. You know, you may never, the tree may never fall on your roof, right? You're not doing this to store up some kind of credit so that what goes around comes around. Come on, this is not self-interest. So there's a lot in that right understanding of interest that maybe we'd have to parse out a little bit more if we wanted to add exactness. But I think that leads me to say something like, you know, I wouldn't trust, if the Democratic Party started to say they wanted to, you know, we want to defeat Trump because he's not a good civic friend and he's not promoting civic friendship. I would distrust that, right? However good the intentions, I think there might be a kind of lack of fit here with democracy as far as civic friendship being an ideology or the appropriate democratic ideology, liberal democratic ideology. But for theorists, I really find that's, you know, we theorists, you know, whatever, you know, other faults we have, we can't afford to get this wrong, right? And to just accept the ideology. So if, you know, like Tocqueville, if you interview somebody and he says something that's not true, you need to register that it's not true, right? If civic friendship is actually going on, in a way, of course it matters how citizens describe it. And if they misdescribe it, that misdescription, that matters. That's important. But in another sense, you can't afford to just take the citizen view of that. If citizens have a low view of themselves, low from a certain perspective, low from perhaps the perspective of what's actually going on. Yeah, take that into account, but also take into account what's actually going on. And if that's more noble, you know, and more beautiful, that I think theorists at least need to know that and be talking about that, right? And maybe there would be good trickle-down effects of that later, but perhaps it all starts with theory. I think civic friendship is mostly for theorists to talk about now, not to become a slogan or for, you know, political discourse to starting there. Hmm. Would be a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it reminds me of the communitarian movement, which I wanted to ask you about next, which you also discuss. You talk about Michael Sandel most especially, because this is another set of theorists who are engaged in roughly the similar project, right? To sort of overcome the atomism implicit in liberalism by training our eyes on community. And I take it your beef is that maybe they go too far, right, in the direction of kind of, you know, the emphasis on virtue and losing yourself in community without this attachment to these lower desires like utility. So Tocqueville is too low, but the communitarians are too high. Is that, do I have that right?
Yeah, or Tocqueville's Americans. Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I think my, you know, criticisms of people like Sandel and Walzer probably come across as harsh. There's a way in which these are my people, really. So again, the internecine strife is always more savage than I. Of course, I admire their work very much, and I'm glad for what they've done. But yeah, that it really is a place where I think the revival of Aristotle kind of went off the rails, and yeah, right. Virtue might be too. Not that virtue doesn't occur in modern society, but it can't be a basis for anything. And I thought the Aristotle's money and honor as the two analogs of love, which he calls civic friendship, was so much more realistic than anything I was hearing from the communitarians. You know, first of all, it's not love strictly, it's an analogy to love. And then the analogies are actually two things that we don't even think are love anymore. I'm not sure anybody ever did, right? I mean, you can kind of say, well, honor, yeah, that's esteem. People who love each other esteem each other. So, okay, I can kind of see that. Money is at most a kind of marker for the esteem you're getting or deserving. So it just struck me that what the communitarians lacked was a kind of recipe for scaling up from these very small associations that, of course, sometimes do act on virtue. They're sort of like families. You know, the person with the most virtue often presides in the chair. You know, they really admire that woman and they want her in the top spot. And, you know, associations act like that, and they can be, that can be wonderful. But those little islands don't say anything about a society-wide civic friendship. And I think if there's no society-wide civic friendship, then those associations are not really civic either. They might be civic in a kind of secondary sense, that some of them are trying to improve civil society, or possibly their political movements or associations. That's wonderful. I would never, you know, say there's anything wrong with that. But I don't think that they are. I think there has to be a society-wide civic friendship for these associations to themselves really be civic. That each association needs to somehow open out onto the whole. If they're just closed in on themselves, no matter what good works they're doing, I don't think we can call it civic friendship, because, of course, we have this civic political distinction, one word we got from Greek, one word we got from Latin, and we've started to use them to mean different things. When I say civic friendship, I could as easily say political friendship. It just doesn't sound as good, and there's a reason it doesn't sound as good. It's this distinction that we've made. I think if you want to start using the word civic or civil in a way that excludes politics, then I think we've left true civic friendship behind. I think it has to be political somehow.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways it strikes me that there's a difference between some of the communitarians and you is that the communitarians tend to talk a lot about democracy and the way in which democracy engenders virtue and a sense of community. And your emphasis is much more on the kind of associational life and also on sentiments that, I mean, you do have some policy matters that share in common. I mean, you have this discussion about national service in the conclusion, for example, as a way to sort of engender a sense of national community, which is well taken and also broadly aligned with some communitarians. But I don't know what you think about that thought about democracy. I mean, it often strikes me. I mean, I have this sort of elevated thoughts when I read Sandel and he talks about participation and public life and whatnot, and it sounds great. But it also seems a little bit high-minded, and that maybe something more like the kind of commercial, you know, laboring elements that you emphasize is more realistic. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, and that we shouldn't lose the political side of that labor. When it's a labor union fighting for rights, we see the political side.
Right.
But
right.
It's very easy to, you know, I think we went through this sort of season in American politics where commerce sort of came unmoored from politics, and international commerce was sort of better than national commerce because, heck, it's bigger and, you know, more boats are being raised. And it's not that that was simply false, but it did sort of have a kind of trans-political hope about it that I think we've all had our fingers burnt now. And we realized that that was that kind of maybe went beyond what the human being is capable of, at least right now. So I'd want to stress commerce, but that, yeah, we don't lose the political side of it. And then I guess maybe a way to rescue a little bit of Walzer's or Sandel's participatory democracy. I mean, I think we can't expect a bunch of people to go out and volunteer. That seems a bit pie in the sky, but what we can do is keep making people do things like jury duty, right? Very important, right? The more people who serve on a jury, the better. I know it costs a lot, but, you know, this kind of plea bargaining stuff, I think, has gotten out of hand. It's much better to have jury trials, and the more citizens that have to take time off from work for that, the better. It's really a school of political virtue and fellowship. I don't want to rule virtue completely out. I just don't want it to be our basis. Civic friendship is not a friendship based on virtue, but the more civic friendly we are, the better we'll behave. And so I think virtue, Aristotle actually has a sort of separate category here. He calls it citizen virtue. The more citizen virtue comes in kind of the back door via our feelings. I know that sounds modern. I think it is sort of more of a take on Aristotle than just Aristotle himself, but I think it's appropriate to liberal democracy that maybe the feelings are going to lead to virtue rather than somehow virtue leading to the feelings.
Right, because I mean, the dime store version of Aristotle is that you have the ethics and it teaches you what the virtues are, and then the politics comes right after that, and that's the institutional mechanism for cultivating the virtues. But that's not how you read it, right? So it's the that politics develops something like, well, you could say a little bit about what political concord is for Aristotle. This is sort of the centerpiece of your account of political friendship in the last part. And, you know, how can we possibly have friendship in a mass society? And Aristotle's answer is something like political concord, which is like analogous to friendship, but not exactly friendship. So maybe you could say a little bit about political concord as a way to sort of generate the this.
Yeah. Right. Another one of his analogies. Concord, the Latin term sort of bespeaks two hearts beating as one. The actual Greek word homonoia is much more about same mind or like-mindedness. But I don't think it's unemotional, like-mindedness about things of practical importance, big things, he says, of practical importance. This is what civic friendship consists in for large societies, or not these smaller associations, but the society en masse.
What's useful, how should we conduct our foreign policy? This is an explicit example. Whether offices should be elective, that's another of his examples. I kind of run with that one. I mean, I think that's really, for Aristotle at least, I think for us too, how offices are distributed really is the regime. It's the constitution, not necessarily in the written sense, but in, you know, the way we're constituted. And agreement on that seems to me to be fundamental. I guess I said earlier that I'm pretty sanguine, but I do think there are issues, you know, that America faces. That both left and right have tried to use the judiciary to change the Constitution without actually amending it. on the written side of things now, the written constitution. But so obviously there are still, there are some disagreements about what our constitution ought to be, but it strikes me that there's a lot of agreement too. And I was saying earlier, I'm kind of heartened that I see my progressive friends saying a lot of the same things about defending the Constitution these days that I used to hear from my conservative friends, you know, during the Obama administration or the Clinton administration. And so that's, you know, although we can't admit it, polarization keeps us from admitting it, there actually is quite a bit of agreement about the Constitution and its enormous worth for us. And so I would sanguinely call that, well, that's agreement about the regime. That shows a kind of like-mindedness, even if we don't want to admit it.
I just have two final questions, sort of stepping back from your project to sort of have a more synoptic view. I mean, one is a question about your view of friendship and the new nationalist era, maybe. And the last is a question about friendship in the coronavirus era. So to start with the first one, you again, as you say in the preface, the sort of book was finishing up when you were after the 2016 election, which was really a kind of watershed, and lots of people have talked about how we're, you know, moved away from a kind of cosmopolitan neoliberal era to a more nationalistic era. I wanted to get your take on what your thoughts were for what the effect of that shift is on the possibility or viability of civic friendship. Is that one that is beneficial? I mean, in some ways, you know, nationalism kind of sounds like friendship, or is it deleterious? I mean, brings out more of those anger emotions.
Right. Yeah. It does. It almost seems kind of like the flip side of civic friendship, the anger that shows that there's a love, or, you know, that, I mean, I don't like the term nationalism. I feel like it's a throwback. We've lived through that. You know, if you read history, you know enough that you don't really want to be a nationalist. But I don't. Yeah, I think it's correct to move in that direction, to the extent that cosmopolitanism is not the only alternative. So I guess I'd want to say that what's good in nationalism is misnamed, and it seems, yeah, to determine whether it's deleterious or not, I'd have to be able to say whether it's taking us further from civic friendship to misname it, to have something like it and misname it, or is it better to have it and have it misunderstood? And I feel that's beyond my pay grade, and I'm kind of, this would be more like, you know, blogging rather than writing a book. I know your last two questions, that's kind of what you're hoping for, my hot take or whatever. But yeah, I definitely think it was a needed correction. I'm glad to see in some ways that the extremes of left and right are now saying the same thing. I wish they weren't ganging up against the middle. To contradict myself slightly, I wish they could see that they were saying the same thing and didn't have to characterize it differently, you know, just to be different from the other extreme. Yeah, I would hate to, move back in the cosmopolitan direction without thinking through how, you know, a real world community would be based in national communities, in civic friendships. But yeah, I mean, the word national just has too many, you know, it's got birth sort of in it. And I find that just does not match up with the American regime as I know it. birth is always important, but you know, you can move here and become just as good a citizen as, or better than someone who was born here. So I guess the short answer is, I don't know. Yes, we've had a needed correction, but could we just be bouncing, you know, in kind of a pendulum swing further and further to extremes and missing real civic friendship with each extreme? That would be my fear.
And we're on lockdown still. Week 11, week 20, week 50. I'm not sure. I don't remember. The pandemic and civic friendship, I mean, it got me thinking on reading all about friendship and not having seen my friends in person in it was 3 months. Presumably the coronavirus is bad for civic friendship. We can't interact with other friends, but maybe there's another way to look at it. I didn't know if you had thoughts about that now as you're also living through this.
I haven't really, but yeah, I think you're right that it's bad for associations. We need to be in each other's spray zone or whatever to truly associate.
I was thinking about, handshakes, right? The decline of handshakes is, the friendship involves a kind of physical contact.
It really does. As far as society-wide civic friendship goes, I mean, I do think this was a kind of maybe a missed opportunity. It just struck me at the beginning of the outbreak how incredibly important these nested spheres of fellowship are. People who don't have families in this lockdown, even one like mine, the nuclear family of four, they would have to be going crazy, right? Where I suppose some families together locked down are driving each other crazy, but I'm with four beautiful people that I love every day, that and we don't have to be socially distant from each other. What a blessing. And similarly with the nation states, how important it became what country you're in, right? Across the border from Germany, who got this right, is the Netherlands, who got it wrong, right? Amazing. All these things that we sort of, I think maybe in sillier seasons thought we had transcended, or maybe we don't need families, or maybe we don't need nations, right? They impose themselves on us. Nature is in a way reimposing itself on us. But yeah, I mean, I guess I feel like, unfortunately, we've sort of even polarized the coronavirus into a he said, she said, and maybe missed an opportunity. It does seem like we kind of lived through a few months there where we could have had a kind of new deal based around something like the Green New Deal, but the coronavirus New Deal, kind of war footing to bring us all together to fight this. And obviously, these countries that we admire, even envy for getting things right. We also are rivals with them, but oftentimes, sometimes in the case of China, more and more of a rivalry of enmity, but also in case of Germany and other places that have done better, we're friendly rivals as well, and we emulate them, and we see that, look what's possible when people roll up their sleeves and get together on things. So, maybe there's been a missed opportunity. Maybe it's not really missed. I mean, I do think, unfortunately, this is going to go on for a while. It looks like we've got at least a year of more opportunity for another year, maybe two, before the vaccine comes out, and we once again use technology and our mastery of nature to substitute for civic friendship.
Well, Paul, this was a really enjoyable conversation. So thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Oh, it's a great pleasure.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.